In 1910, Muscatine was a bustling industrial town. The pearl button business was making factory owners rich while workers barely scraped by. A conflict was inevitable. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. When Pearl McGill arrived in Muscatine as a young woman, she was overwhelmed by the smell and the poor conditions for workers. She was predisposed to be sympathetic to the factory owners. Her uncle was one, but wound up becoming a committed labor activist, risking her life to make the lives of others better. Jeffrey Copeland is the author of the book Shell Games, The Life and Times of Pearl McGill, Industrial Spy and Pioneer Labor Activist. I'll talk with him. Join our conversation after the news. This is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Pearl McGill moved to Muscatine in 1910. She'd been promised a job at a pearl button factory and was hoping to save up enough money to go to school and become a teacher. Her life quickly got much more complicated. She's the subject of a new book by Jeffrey Copeland. He's professor and head of the Department of Languages and Literature at the University of Northern Iowa. The book is Shell Games, The Life and Times of Pearl McGill, Industrial Spy and Pioneer Labor Activist. Hello, Jeffrey.
Good morning, Charity. Thanks for having me on this morning.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And paint a picture for us. Muscatine in 1910. What was the city like?
Well, I opened the book purposely by having Pearl get off of the train at the main station there and immediately saying, "What in the world is that smell?" Well, Muscatine, Iowa at that time was starting to be the pearl button capital of the country, but it was also the stink capital of the country. And it's because of the clamming industry and the pearl button industry. It was a place that was so busy with activity. It was like Pennsylvania Station on a Saturday night in the 1940s. Constant movement, constant shipping of the raw materials needed for the industry. It was everybody's image of what a major city would be like.
A bustling industrial town, really.
Yes.
Pearl McGill arrived in town, and like so many other young women, she was drawn there for the work. But tell me a little bit about her.
She's a very interesting individual from the get-go. As a youngster, she wanted to become a teacher. That was her goal. But there were so few positions for women at that time, especially in that part of rural Iowa. She knew she was going to have to leave the town of Grandview, where she was growing up, in order to get the funds to meet her dreams. So through a very nice set of circumstances related to what her family was involved in, which was also the button industry, she was able to secure a job in Muscatine, Iowa, where she would be working in a plant, a button manufacturing plant, that belonged to a friend of the family. And her plan initially was to earn just enough money to leave to go to school to get that dream of becoming a teacher.
When did you first learn about Pearl McGill? I mean, she's not a woman who is well known.
No, and this is something I always tell people as a little bit of context. There would not have been a Norma Rae if there had not been a Pearl McGill first and others like Pearl. But in order for me even to find out about Pearl, the chain of events was actually kind of funny. I wrote a book, Inman's War, A Soldier's Story of Life in a Colored Battalion in World War II, that came out at the end of 2006, beginning of 2007. That book was based on a series of letters I actually found at a flea market. Well, at that time, a lot of people were fascinated that a book would grow from a pile of letters. So I had people literally coming out of the woodwork telling me about piles of letters. You should read these. You should write a story about this. You should do that. Well, actually, I helped four individuals write their own stories based on letters that they had. But several people at that time said to me, "Do you know the Pearl McGill letters?" And I didn't. And I just sort of wrote the name down and I said, "Well, I'll check into this later." Well, one of the individuals was pretty persistent and said, "Do you realize this story has in it Helen Keller, has the Titanic, has people just dying and disappearing?" And when I got to that point, it was like, okay, you have my attention. So at that point, I decided I'd do a little bit more research and find out who this Pearl McGill was. And I'm glad I did.
And this book is literary nonfiction. So it is an account of events that actually happened, featuring people that actually lived. But you chose to write the book in Pearl's voice. So obviously it took a lot of creativity and inventiveness on your part. But why did you make that decision instead of a nonfiction account?
Literary nonfiction, to me, is the most exciting genre of literature because anyone can look up historical events and find out what happened. It's the why the events happen that's most interesting to me. In literary nonfiction, all events of the story, all major events of the story are true, but the writer has the luxury and liberty of putting the words in the voices of the characters so people can see the human side, the heart behind the story involved. Now, I want this to be read up front. In doing that, in putting it in the voices of the characters, a writer had better make sure that all of the facts are accurate and we know exactly how those people would have put the words forward and how they would have acted. For literary nonfiction, there are five things that must be known about every major character: what they say, what they do, what others say about them, their physical characteristics, and their motives. So it takes me about a year to do the background research for a story of this type. That's the hardest part, which I dearly love. Heaven help me. And then it takes me about 6 months to actually write the story. But when I do, when I'm finished, the facts are accurate, and people will then know why the events took place.
How did you get to know Pearl McGill? I mean, you mentioned the letters. Was she someone who corresponded a great deal with other people?
She did. She was an incredibly gifted writer, but the jackpot for me is something that every writer dreams about. In doing my background research to gather information for the story, I was actually at the Muscatine History and Industry Museum, known locally as the Button Museum in Muscatine. I met the director there, Kristen McHugh Johnson at the time. And while I'm visiting with her, she leaned across the table and she said, "Do you realize that Pearl McGill's niece is still alive and she lives right outside of Muscatine?" And you could have knocked me over with a feather. I didn't know that. So I made arrangements to go visit the niece, and it was like opening the door to the story. The niece, Jean Burns, is one of the most incredible, wonderful, kindest people I have ever met in my life. She opened her doors to me. She gave me my own set of Pearl's letters, all of them, including many that were not in the archives that had the Pearl letters. Gave me never-before-seen photographs by other folks. Just all sorts of documents related to the story. So I really hit the mother lode.
Oh, definitely. So much of, and we'll find out more about this in a moment, but so much of what she was doing during the time that you write about was secret. Who was she telling about this in her letters?
Well, at first she was keeping her mouth shut because she learned very quickly that very bad things happened to people who were on either side of the fence. As I heard you mention earlier in a promo for this interview today, she initially went there with the understanding she would see what the workers were doing, pass this information along to her uncle and the individual who ran the Button Company at the time, because they wanted to find out what the workers were doing to build the fledgling Button Workers Protective Union. So actually, she started out somewhat as a spy for the side of ownership. But once she got there and she saw what was taking place in the factories, she shifted dramatically in her opinion and her focus.
How old was she when she came to town in 1910?
16 years old.
Really, just a child.
I know.
And she arrives in town and you mentioned the smell. So she's almost overcome by the smell at first, but she also walks into a chain of events that really could have taken her life right then. What happened to her as she arrived in Muscatine?
Well, when she got in Muscatine, she immediately had her purse stolen. So she had all of her main valuables, all of her money taken from her. Typical thing, you know, parents warn people, keep your pocketbook close to you as you travel. And she even joked about it in one of her letters that she didn't pay attention to her parents and look what happened. So she was there basically stranded without any sort of way to get to where she was going to be living. So she met up with an individual that it's all described in the book who helps her, provides her some funds, but she decides to save the money and walk to where she was going to be living. Bad mistake. This was awful. You know, it's bad enough you get to a new city, you're lost, you're broke. But she fell for one of the oldest gags going in Muscatine at the time, which was to have her go down underneath the bridge where the clammers live. And I'm sure we'll talk more about them later. Mm-hmm. And went into this clamming camp that was off limits to those who were not in that part of the industry. And it almost cost her life immediately. So she basically crossed a line socially, economically, and just in terms of her general safety, almost immediately. She fell in a hole, basically.
And she didn't even really know where she lived because she hadn't seen her lodgings before, and the card that had the address for where she was supposed to live was in her purse. So not only has she had her purse stolen and all of her money stolen, and then she gets jumped in the clamming camp, she still doesn't even know how to get to her home.
Right. And in the course of events here, she meets one of my favorite characters I discovered when I did the research, Gunboat Gaston. This wasn't his true name, of course. This was a name given to him because he was a person that everyone happened to be really afraid of because of all the stories that had spread around. And the contrast to 16-year-old Pearl McGill in this tough guy, Gunboat Gaston, what a way to start her experience in Muscatine.
And she, once she did get to her lodgings, which did happen eventually with the help of that character who shows up again later, she was supposed to be rooming with two young women and one that she knew from her hometown, right?
Yes, one that she had grown up with and knew as a small child. Very different individuals in terms of personalities, the alpha and the omega.
And we will get to know them in just a moment. And we'll also I'll have you do a little bit of reading from your book so we can hear the voice of Pearl McGill.
Oh,
my guest today is Jeffrey Copeland. He is the author of the new book, Shell Games, The Life and Times of Pearl McGill, Industrial Spy and Pioneer Labor Activist. He's also a professor and head of the Department of Languages and Literature at the University of Northern Iowa. And you're welcome to join our conversation today if your family has connection to the pearl button industry in Muscatine and you have a story to share. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Jeffrey Copeland. He's a professor and head of the Department of Languages and Literature at the University of Northern Iowa. And his latest book is about a woman named Pearl McGill. The book is called Shell Games, The Life and Times of Pearl McGill, Industrial Spy and Pioneer Labor Activist. And we've been talking about her arrival in Muscatine, Iowa in 1910. She was 16 years old. She came to town. She was promised a job at a pearl button factory. And she was hoping to save enough money to go back to school and become a teacher. Before the break, we were just mentioning that she was going to room with two young women. One of them she knew from home, and her name is Maddie. Tell me a little bit about Maddie.
Maddie was kind of an interesting character. Probably today they would have said that you couldn't tie her down. That's an expression my family uses. Just so full of life and so active and really so opinionated for a time when the industry was so drawn by the sex roles and sex role stereotypes of an incredibly strong young woman who was not shy at all in sharing her opinions, not at all.
And she was really, although we find out later, she doesn't tell Pearl everything. She's still pretty darn open.
Yes, she is. She never meant an opinion she didn't want to share.
And again, were those accounts in Pearl's letters? Did she write about Maddie? She is a real person, right?
Yes, they were. But I also did some research to find relatives for Maddie as well. And I wanted to find out how she held herself, how she spoke, what the tilt of her voice was like. And in doing so, I found out that she was just an incredible human being.
And the other roommate's name is Viola.
Right.
And we'll find out more about her later. She's kind of a woman of mystery to Pearl. She's in and out, and she doesn't have a steady job. She tends to disappear for periods.
Yes, and there's a reason for that.
Right, and we'll find out more about that in a little while. But I would love for you to read a little bit from the first day of work for Pearl. This is Maddie and Pearl are on their way to work, and Maddie has really taken Pearl under her wing, but in a little bit of a rough way.
Well, she does. Thank you. I believe if it's okay, I'll start reading this passage now.
Yes.
About halfway and I should preface it by saying this is on the way to work for the very first time, the first day at work. About halfway to the factory, Maddie turned to me and without breaking stride said, "Now don't take this the wrong way. I'm not trying to boss you around, but I want you to know some things before we get there." She paused, took several more steps, and continued, "There are rules at the factory, and I don't want you to embarrass me." "Go ahead. I'll be grateful," I said, thinking about how I had initially dressed for work. "Rule number one is simple. Unless you're given permission, don't touch anything that doesn't belong to you. Other than the big equipment, most things, from the drill bits that cut the shells to the sewing needles used to put the buttons on cards, are owned by the workers themselves. The owners should provide these things, but they don't. This is just one more way they take advantage of everyone, cut down on their costs, and increase their profits. So if you touch something and break it, you could be destroying somebody's way of making a living. Some workers might just kill you for doing something like that. In short, keep your hands to yourself." Without giving me time to say anything, she continued, "Rule number two, keep your mouth shut and mind your own business. You're going to hear and see things that will shock you. Be seen and not heard, and never talk to the supervisors unless you absolutely have to." "Give me more details," I cut in. "What do you mean?" Turning very serious, Maddie said sharply, "Pearl, I don't know you well enough yet to say anything more about this. You just keep your mouth shut while we're at work, and if you want to ask me questions, save them for when I get home. Understand?" Although I really didn't, I nodded. That seemed to satisfy her, so she continued, "Rule number three, always look busy, even when you're not. Not all of them, but many of the supervisors would just as soon fire you as look at you. All they need is an excuse, and idle hands is one they jump on. I shouldn't be telling you this, but some of the supervisors fire people on purpose just to open up jobs. Then they take money from those looking for work and put them in those spots. Basically, they sell jobs, and they're good at it. It's a racket, plain and simple. I don't think most of the owners know about this, but I doubt many would do anything about it even if they did. Make it look like you're busy all the time. You better or you'll be out on the street, and I'll be out a share of our rent." "Why doesn't somebody turn those supervisors in? That just isn't right," I said, huffing for breath as the incline of the street suddenly increased. "Shake the straw out of your hair, country girl," Maddie replied, shaking her head. She continued, her voice rising, "Rule number four, don't get hurt. If you get injured and miss work, this is what will happen. The company won't pay your medical bills. You'll have to cover that yourself, and you won't be able to afford it. Then you'll miss work. You won't get paid, and somebody else will be in your place when you try to come back. That's just the way it is. If you do get hurt, try to hide it if you can. Those supervisors might see you slow down and fire you for what they say will be for your own sake, which is just a lot of hooey. They will want you gone so they can sell your job to somebody else. So if you get hurt, let me know, and I'll tell you what to do. Got it?"
That's Jeffrey Copeland reading from his new book, Shell Games, The Life and Times of Pearl McGill, Industrial Spy and Pioneer Labor Activist. And that was Maddie, the new roommate of Pearl McGill, explaining to her how to get through her first day on the job. And she, in a a little later passage, she encourages Pearl to maybe fake an injury on the appointed day that they agree on, so that Maddie could win some money in a pool. They always bet on the day that somebody will get seriously injured when the new person arrives at the factory.
And one of the things I was most horrified by as I did this research, and I actually made a reproduction I take with me when I do a book events, is the dreaded finger jar. So many people lost fingers, well, eyes as a matter of fact too, but fingers in the industry, that when they lost a finger, they would put it in a mason jar filled with alcohol. So they would put all these jars of fingers at various places around the factory is sort of a cautionary tale. If you don't pay attention, this is going to happen to you. Well, they had a betting pool on Pearl to see how long her long fingers would actually last. So, yeah.
And when she arrived at the factory, though, she found that her job wasn't exactly what she expected.
Not a bit. The way this was going to work was that Mr. Blanton, who ran the button factory, who was a friend of her uncle's, he was going to have her work in what was called reverse order. In other words, start at the very end of the button-making process and work backward so she could see the entire process unfold. But this was really a ruse. Really, this was just a cover. She was going to work in all the different stations so she could see what the individuals were doing, find out how they were working, if they were working, if they were stealing from the company. Also, so she could find out any news about the emerging union, the Button Workers Protective Union.
So she was supposed to be a spy for management.
That you put it right. She was supposed to be a spy for management.
And she didn't know that in advance of working there, although her uncle had made this promise before she got there. Was she conflicted in taking that job?
No, at first not really at all, because she had grown up with ownership, and basically her uncle had told her, what you're going to find are a bunch of lazy, shiftless, no-good, ne'er-do-well bums. And he even said that most of the injuries in factories happen because of laziness or careless behavior on the part of the workers there. So when Pearl was told that she was going to be checking them out, finding out what was going on with the formation of the union, she pretty much just shrugged her shoulders at first and thought, well, these people don't deserve rights anyway, so why not?
And she had heard her uncle talk about the financial situation of a factory owner, and she really felt like, from his perspective, the workers were taking advantage of the owners, and the owners were barely getting by, although that was not the situation.
No, it wasn't. But from that perspective, she heard, well, they're thieves. They'll rob you blind if you let them. So she expected to find people who were going to stick their hands in her pockets at every opportunity.
But at the same time, she moves in with Maddie and Viola, and she finds that even though she gets to start at a significantly higher salary than most factory workers, they're still barely able to make rent. She's barely able to save money. And Maddie's actually stealing food so they have enough to eat.
You know, this is something that it was very shocking to me when I started doing the research for this. The amount of pay given to the workers in the factory was just a pitiful amount. It barely kept their noses above water, barely kept a roof over their head. If they had several children or other relatives they were supporting, in some cases they really couldn't. They had to steal food just to survive. And basically, they were trapped. Without the workers' rights, the owners could use them up. They used them until they were injured or too old to work anymore. They would throw them away. And because there was such a steady stream of those wanting to work, they just filled in the holes as others dropped out.
And as we've seen in cities everywhere all over the world, when there are a lot of jobs available, people come into town and housing is at a premium.
It is. And that's why they were living in an apartment, for lack of a better term, above a jewelry store in downtown Muscatine. And I was actually able to track down where that was and see the view they had. And that helped me tremendously in writing the book as well. But, yeah, housing was at a premium, definitely. And people had to share their lodgings with others.
So as Pearl entered this life, she was keeping secrets from Maddie, of course, because she was hired to be a spy for management. But she also found herself not really able to do the job she had been hired to do as she got to know people. What changed for her?
What changed for her more than anything else is she discovered the individuals that she worked with were not the lazy, shiftless bums that she was prepared to meet. She found out that these were good, God-loving, wonderful people just trying to make a living so that their families could have any kind of a life carved out. She found out that they weren't thieves. They weren't – well, some were, but – most of them were not stealing from the factories. Most had very good work ethics. It was just that the working conditions were not good.
And she also sort of had a baptism by fire in finding out about the emerging labor movement and the conflict that was causing in the community. It's a Saturday night, and she goes out with Viola and Maddie. What happens?
Well, there were a lot of speakers at that time trying to rally support for the emerging unions. But for the owners, these people might as well have had horns under their hair. They did not want these people to give these messages. Well, one of the individuals involved, one of the people involved in the early labor movement as well, showed up in Muscatine. He was going to tell them why they should organize, why they should get together, what that could possibly do for their lives. She's in a large crowd, and I don't want to give too much away of the book here, but while she is there, while she is listening to what this individual has to say, a riot basically starts out, and it is instigated by the owners. It's a way of trying to disperse the crowd. A lot of violence takes place. Individuals are hurt. And this was very typical for the early gatherings to deal with the emerging unions because on the one hand, the owners knew that if the unions were formed, that was going to cost them a heck of a lot of money and therefore their profits would go down. Now, I don't want to make this sound totally one-sided. This is not just a story about how workers were being abused. One of the things that I discovered in doing the research that I thought really helped balance the scales here is the owners had to have a certain measure of profit, especially at this time, or they were going to go belly up, and then there wouldn't have been jobs for anybody. The owners, especially in the button industry, were just switching over from steam power to electricity to operate their machines. The advent of electricity and the continued development of machines using the electricity, it was very expensive for them to get the new equipment. So on the one hand, they were torn toward one side and helping the workers. On the other hand, they knew if they didn't build up the businesses and move with technology and the advancements, they were going to be out.
And they were also facing a crisis on the horizon in that they had been polluting the Mississippi River to a really disgusting and horrible degree. And also almost all the clams were gone.
Yes. 23 species of clams were totally eliminated through the process of clamming for the button industry. 23 species. Now, think of this. The clams at the bottom of the Mississippi River, when they had the shell open, they were also influential in the filtering of the water. And I was able to get some of the early reports about this that said the water in the Mississippi at that time, upstream at least, a person could still drink it and not worry about, you know, problems from that. Well, as the clam beds were obliterated, the filtering provided by the clams was removed. And that is when the Mississippi River and other places around the country where the same thing was taking place, that's where the rivers really started to get polluted and really get nasty. And this is one of the real tragedies of the pearl button industry is the pollution that resulted from it that's still there today.
Right. It really created an environmental disaster and destroyed the industry from within. So at the same time, all of these things were happening and putting pressure on management and on the workers. And I mentioned that event, that night when she went out with Maddie and Viola. And that night, she also discovered how very dark the anti-labor people could be because there were attacks and Viola got injured. Can you tell me what happened?
Yeah, poor Viola. It's a case of being in the wrong place at the wrong time, actually. Because of her injury, she was taken to the local hospital. Her injuries were so severe that that was basically the end of her life as she knew it. She hung on. She was able to do the best she could to fight the injuries, but she basically had a concussion, and a terrible one, at a time when we didn't have a lot of medical bullets to deal with such issues. Basically, people got well or they died. And this was a very serious lesson, not just for Pearl, but all those who knew her and loved her, that if you're there and these events are going to take place, you're going to have the same risks. So in a way, she became sort of a poster child for what could happen if you stand up for your rights.
I'm talking with Jeffrey Copeland. His book is called Shell Games, The Life and Times of Pearl McGill, Industrial Spy and Pioneer Labor Activist. And we're talking about the labor movement in the 1910s, 19-teens, in Muscatine, Iowa, as the Pearl button industry was at its height, although facing a number of crises in different directions. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment, and you're welcome to join us. If your family had experiences in the Pearl button industry, if you have a legacy that you'd like to share with us, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is Jeffrey Copeland. He is the author of the new book, Shell Games, The Life and Times of Pearl McGill, Industrial Spy and Pioneer Labor Activist. She moved to Muscatine, Iowa in 1910 and began work at a Pearl button factory. It was a bustling industrial town at that time, and the factory owners were doing fairly well. The workers were just scraping by. Really, a conflict between labor and management was becoming inevitable in that town, and Pearl found herself really caught in the middle because she was hired to be a spy for management, but she also found herself living the life of an underpaid worker and really interacting with and getting to know and understand those who were in the labor movement. And after Viola's injury, Pearl eventually discovered something else about Viola. She found that while she was being a spy for management, Viola was also a spy. Can you tell me what Viola's job was?
You know, Viola was such an interesting individual because on the outward side, she sort of appeared like Lucy Ricardo from I Love Lucy. She was, you see, she seemed sort of an airhead, but she was anything but. She was what was called a peace worker. An individual who would fill in for injured workers at the different factories around the town. And this was all by design, though. To the outside person, it looked like she couldn't hold a steady job or get one. But what she was actually doing was working for the union. And by going in as a peace worker, working a day here, 2 days there, she was able to infiltrate all of the different factories, find out what was going on, find out who was pro-union, who was not. Formed an incredibly valuable service for the emerging union. And after her injury, that's finally when Pearl said, all right, I have to draw a line in the sand here. But, and I found this fascinating, Pearl didn't really want to side just with the workers. She felt in her heart and her soul that what could be best in a situation like this would be to bring everyone to the table. She understood the point of view of the owners, she understood the point of view of the workers, and she believed that communication was what was going to serve the day. So it wasn't that she came running out and said, all right, this is it. I am so pro-union, that's what I'm going to do. She realized that the owners had to have a stake as well at the table for the discussions. Otherwise, this would all fall apart like a house of cards, and the whole industry would go under.
But she did commit herself to the union cause.
She did.
And that was a tremendous risk for her. I mean, she knew she was risking her life at that moment.
It was an incredible risk. And I don't think it's giving away too much of the book to say that in one particular scene, she is kidnapped along with several other women that the owners suspect to be involved in the union activities. And in a strange sort of irony, it is because of her relationship to ownership, which comes to light, that she manages to get out of a horrible situation. I won't say more about that. But for some of the other women, they didn't make it.
She wants to bring people to the table, but that was also the goal of the union movement at the same time. I mean, they were threatening a strike, but wasn't the goal to negotiate?
Well, the goal was to negotiate, but nobody could get them to the table. Pearl was the perfect poster person for rights of workers. And she had ties with the owners. She now had ties with the workers. She was the one that could stick out both hands and hold to both sides firmly. So they made use of her that way, and they made no bones about it. And Pearl talked about this in her letters. They just said flat out, we are going to use you because we need you. You're someone who has inroads in both camps. Therefore, help.
And did they actually use the term poster girl? I mean, did they make it clear to her that they were going to make her face public?
Yeah, they did. They did. And this was a tremendous risk for her because back home, her family was on the side of ownership. So she was risking alienating her family on the one side. And on the other, she was afraid she could have been knocked off because how did the workers really know she was siding with them? How did they really know she wasn't just a spy?
How did her family react? Do you know?
I left a lot of that out of the book, but I can tell you this. They did not react well. They reacted pretty badly. Her mother was very proud of her for taking a stand, but at the same time, this was going against the culture that had been in their family for a long time.
And again, I mean, she's a 16, 17-year-old girl doing all of this.
Yes.
So the pressure of the family must have been very difficult for her.
Yes.
Did she express that?
She did. She continued to write letters to her mother quite frequently, but as I looked at them, I noticed they became more and more clinical and about her work and less about the family and what others were doing. And I think this was probably a reflection of how torn she was internally and how she was feeling a little bit of alienation. But a lot of those are the early workers who fought for rights like that. They sacrificed everything in the name of trying to make lives better for other individuals. And Pearl was like that.
She has an official job with the union. She's the secretary. And so when it finally is time to bring management and union representatives to the table, when the management has decided that they want to avoid a strike at all costs, so they've locked the workers out, and the union has to act right now, they finally do get an opportunity to sit down with management, and she has to be there face to face with the man who employed her and with other people in management that she had connections with.
And her boss at the factory, he was livid when he saw her there and found out why she was there. It's like, okay, you're the ultimate Benedict Arnold. You're Judas rolled into one here. And she had to stand there and take it. She just had to take it. But if an individual believes that strongly in a cause and feels that right about something, that becomes part and parcel of it. If you can't stand that heat, it's time to get out.
These negotiations that she's part of, this first round of negotiations that she was part of, were extremely successful for the workers. What was the outcome?
Well, they were successful initially, but there's a caveat that goes with that. A lot of it was sound and fury signifying nothing. In other words, the owners were more willing to say, okay, we'll do this, we'll do this, we'll think about this, we'll table this for discussion another time, because they were at a juncture as well. If they lost the labor force and they couldn't do the type of work they needed to do for research and development and for making the industry move ahead, it was going to cost them the whole industry. Everything was going to go kaput. So they made some initial concessions, which satisfied the workers. But as it turned out, the initial round, while this was needed, it got everybody together, it didn't go nearly as far as it should have. But there was one major victory. The one huge victory from these early discussions was that the owners, for the very first time, recognized the right of the workers to organize and form the union. So from that point forward, people could then come out and say, I'm part of the union. without fear of reprisals. But I say that out loud, knowing full well that some of the bigger leaders behind the scenes, they still suffered dramatically, and some were killed. Some were killed off.
Jim is on the line from Spencer. Hello, Jim.
Hi, good morning. I'm just curious to know if the toxic nature of the material, the inhalation of dust from producing these buttons is something that was mentioned in your book, and if that's something that people need to know about.
Page 134, I just happened to open up right to it. That's a curse of having a photographic memory. There were more cases of pneumonia, typhus, gangrene than any other place in the entire Midwest put together. The number of miscarriages had by women, the number of lost fingers, eyes, toes in some cases. It was shocking, the conditions that the workers were in. And one that was, it was sort of a badge of honor, but it just shows you how bad things got. The buttons that were different colors were made that way by dye. Red was very popular for buttons in that time period. People would be walking around town with red hands, literally bright red hands from the dye, because the conditions were so bad they had no way to keep clean while they were in the factories. So it was a very visible manifestation of the poor working conditions. You could just about pick them out. Oh, there's a blank cutter over there. I can tell because a person has several fingers gone. Oh, there's somebody in the acid part of the process. Look at their face. I mean, it was pretty gruesome.
Well, and when they went to the table to negotiate, one of the things on their agenda was to ask for medical support for workers. They knew that that was going to get laughed down. But another thing that they did negotiate was just the access to clean water to rinse their hands.
Yeah, in another really bad irony, the water in the plants were the water containers, the vats, were used to soak the shells so that the shells wouldn't be brittle when the holes were drilled out to get the button blanks and make the buttons. So actually, the owners initially were more interested in the health of the shells than they were of their own workers. And that was the only water they had, so they couldn't clean up anywhere else.
This negotiation is kind of the culmination of your story. It's this victory for Pearl McGill and for Maddie and for the people that they were working with in the labor movement. And as you already mentioned, it didn't go far enough and conditions didn't improve that dramatically for workers. But it was a pivotal moment in the life of Pearl McGill. What did she go on to do then?
She was taken under the wing of the Women's Trade Union League, the WTUL, which was a branch of the American Federation of Labor. They took her to Chicago, where they polished her. They taught her a little bit more about giving speeches, how to work a crowd, how to get involved in fundraising, and basically also helped her get enough connections out on the East Coast that Pearl went out to the East Coast and became a spy in other industries as well, everything from the textile industry to the food industry to the furniture manufacturing industry. And she had a pretty good career at that. I chose to end the book when I did because this was a story with 5 pounds of beans in a 1 pound bag. So I wanted to end it at a point that showed just how important Pearl really was in the development of the early unions. But there are literally 3 or 4 other books about Pearl's later life that could be done.
She did eventually go to school and become a teacher.
She did, and she actually got her teaching certificate, both her county and rural teaching certificate, from the University of Northern Iowa, which at that time I believe would have been Iowa State Normal School. And her education, get this, was paid for by Helen Keller.
How did that happen?
Helen Keller knew of Pearl's work, and Pearl knew of Helen's work, of course. They had an admiration for each other. When Helen Keller was traveling through Cedar Falls, she was killing some time down at the train station waiting for a train, and Pearl made arrangements to go visit with her. After the two met and Pearl told her of her ambition to become a teacher, Helen Keller provided her the funds. And she lived on Searley Boulevard, right across from the old auditorium, and from there, the rest is history.
You begin the book not with that introduction of Pearl McGill to Muscatine, but you actually begin the book with two different accounts of murder.
Yes.
With the murder of two young women who were doing the work that Pearl McGill did later on, where she would infiltrate a factory, or what Viola did, where she would infiltrate a factory and find out what was going on there so that she could report back to the union. Were these murders common? Is this something that you found a lot of in your research?
A lot. I framed the story. That's the literary term. I started years after the main story takes place with the murder of these two women. Pearl knew both of them very well. And then I go back to that same time period after the main part of the story closes. And I did so on purpose because I wanted to establish right away just how many people actually made the ultimate sacrifice in the name of establishing workers' rights. You know, anyone can look up a basic Google search and they can see that eventually Pearl was murdered. That's not going to wreck the book for anybody. That's just a very basic thing. Obviously, it doesn't happen during the course of the story. But I can tell you the two who were murdered are there on purpose because there's a parallel with what happens with Pearl much later on in her life. And I wish we had more time to talk about it today, but I'll just say this much. It was assumed for a long time that a certain individual ended up killing Pearl.
And she was 30 years old.
She was 30 years old. And what I do at the back of the book is I have a special section where I present all the information I uncovered while doing the research, and I can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt the person they assumed killed Pearl really did not do it. It is my belief firmly Pearl was assassinated because she was coming back out to fight again for workers' rights, and she was rubbed out. Now, when individuals read this account, I invite them to read it, tell me who they think committed the murder, and then write to me. And then I'll express who I think did it.
What is your hope now that you've written this book? What do you hope people will learn about Pearl McGill? Are you hoping that this will help bring her into Iowa history books, or is this someone that you want people to start learning about for a reason?
I want people to learn about Pearl because in another very tragic irony, this book is loaded with them, and this whole situation is when Pearl did her initial work, 10% of the American labor force, they were in labor unions, 10%. The highest point of percentage of people in labor unions was during World War II, when 35% of all non-agricultural workers were in a labor union. Today in 1912, you're not going to believe this, that number is back down to about 10% nationally. So we've gone the bell curve completely. I want people to know about Pearl and others like her who gave us the rights that we have today as workers in this country, because whole states now are wiping out labor unions. Whole corporations are getting rid of what all these people fought for. It's important for people to see what happened in the past so that we can have a brighter future. And part of that is because of Pearl McGill and others like her.
Jeffrey Copeland, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me today. I enjoyed it.
Jeffrey Copeland is the author of the new book, Shell Games, The Life and Times of Pearl McGill, Industrial Spy and Pioneer Labor Activist. He is also a professor and head of the Department of Languages and Literature at the University of Northern Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Technical support today from Tony Daner in Cedar Falls. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa.